Johnny Barnes, I want to talk about DC statehood with you, and I want to start by talking about the money aspect of that. Colbert King, in a January 29th column in the Washington Post, wrote the following: Congress expressly prohibits the district from taxing the income earned within its borders by non-residents, a power that all states have. Two-thirds of the income earned in the district is earned by non-residents. The federal government, the city's largest employer, uses city services but does not pay property sales or income taxes. Neither do embassies, international institutions, or many tax-exempt nonprofits such as Fannie Mae. Together, they occupy 57% of the district's land.
Yeah, you know, Andrew Bremer, who at one time was on the Federal Reserve Board, Dr. Andrew Bremer, on one occasion was asked, can the district afford to be a state? And after studying the issue and issuing a written report, Dr. Bremer said, the question is really, can the district afford not to be a state? And that is because, Pete, in current dollars, we leave $2.6 billion on the table annually because of our status as a non-state. And let me explain. In addition to all those things that Colby mentioned in his article, there are many other ways that revenue is foregone in the district because we're not a state. And one example that really is troubling to me is that when Congress is embroiled in these budget battles, as they seem to be every Congress in recent years, they haven't passed a budget for America yet, the District of Columbia suffers. That's because our budget, like the budget of the State Department or the Defense Department or HUD or Health and Human Services, any agency, our budget has to be approved by Congress. We're treated like a federal agency. So from the time Vince Gray and Kwame Brown and others formulate the budget for the District of Columbia, whether they include tax increases on the rich or not, until the time we can actually spend that money, at least 18 months elapses from budget formulation to budget implementation before Congress allows us to spend our own money. And 95% of our budget is our money. Our money, yours and mine, Pete. Maybe more yours than mine, I don't know.
No.
No, that, you quickly disabuse me of that notion. But anyway, before we get to serious matter, and I don't mean to make light of it, but before we can spend our own money, 18 months, and here's the consequence of that, and this is the thing that troubles me so much, Pete. You take the stadium. We just spent $700 million to build that stadium over on South Capitol Street. Now, troubled Prince George's County could have built that same stadium under the same terms, at the same time, with the same enhancements, the same exact stadium they could have built for far, far less than what we're spending. And the reason is this. Prince George's County gets a AAA rating on its bonds, and we don't. And the reason we don't get the AAA rating, the bond raters in New York, Solomon Brothers and those, say, it's because your revenue stream is unpredictable. You have an unpredictable revenue stream because Congress has the final say. And so when you have less than a AAA bond rating, you pay more for the money you borrow. That's how you pay for capital improvements. You borrow it over 30 years. And so we're paying more than Prince George's County or any other or most other jurisdictions would pay for the same thing. Now, that's bread and butter. That's rubber meets the road. That ain't about an academic exercise or positions for politicians. That's your money and my money, Pete, that we're paying because of our non-state status, okay? And if you calculate it over 30 years, we could pay for the education. We could pay the education budget if we were competitive in terms of our rating. We could pay for the police department, our public safety budget. That's how much we're losing over time if we were competitive in terms of our rating. So this whole question of can we afford to be a state pales as against the question that Dr. Bremer raised. Can we afford not to be a state? As I said, in addition to all those things that Colby mentioned, and he said it very well, that revenue foregone because of our inability to tax income at its source. Every state in America can tax income where it's earned. 700,000 cars come here every day, and they put potholes in our streets, and they have the pothole papalooza going on right now, fixing the potholes. They use our sewer and water services. They use our police services, our fire department services. They use many services, and they leave nothing behind, nothing except potholes and other things that we have to clean up. You can't get into New York without paying. You can't get out of New York without paying. And we can't impose anything like that because we can't have tolls. We can't, and all this is, these are limitations imposed by Congress. We can't tax private real property that is lucrative. We can't tax Constitution Hall because Congress passed a special charter for Constitution Hall, even though it's a private entity. And there's several like that. In addition to the federal property that's taken off the tax rolls, because no one can tax the federal government. So the revenue foregone amounts to $2.6 billion that we leave on the table every year. If we had $2.6 billion, we wouldn't have to raise taxes. We could cut taxes. If we had $2.6 billion, we wouldn't have to close schools and penny pinch on all the programs. The Fair Budget Committee or Save Our Safety Net Committee wouldn't have anything to fuss about. We could pay for all those important things that are on the chopping block now. And so you have to wonder, where's the vision among our elected officials when it's clear that if they put some time and energy and effort and money behind changing our status, that we would be far better off financially. Puerto Rico spent $20 million last year to advance its statehood efforts. What did we spend? You know, so can we afford not to be a state is a question, I think, Pete. And Colby got it right.
D.C. voting rights versus statehood. Can you explain the difference?
The difference is statehood is permanent. D.C. voting rights is not. Statehood gives us our full bundle of rights. D.C. voting rights does not. Statehood makes us first-class Americans. D.C. voting rights keeps us in a second-class status. I said on one occasion that isn't it strange the web we weave when first we start to deceive? Because, Pete, Roman bath is not Roman, it's Turkish. And a firefly is not a fly, it's a beetle. And a prairie dog is not a dog, it's a rat. And voting rights is not about rights, it's about wrongs. And it's wrong for us to send people to Afghanistan and Iraq and now Libya, and them to come back and be treated differently than everybody else. It's wrong for us to pay more taxes per capita than anybody else in America and then be treated differently than everybody else in America. And it's wrong for every human being on this planet who lives in a country where there is representative government to have representation in their national legislature, and that to come to a screeching halt in the shadow of the Washington Monument only in Washington, D.C., We're out of step with the world community, Pete. No one else suffers under the conditions that we do in Washington, D.C. No one else in the world. And President Reagan used to say, we must extend the perimeters of democracy around the world. But democracy starts at home. And it's a stain. It's a crack in the Liberty Bell. It's a situation that we must change. And statehood is permanent. It's complete. They won't be able to take Eleanor's vote away the way they did. They won't be able to introduce legislation against needle exchange and same-sex marriage. And they won't be able to hold our budget hostage. They won't be able to tell us how to live and tell us how to die. And that's what they do. Any day of the week, every day of the week, for any reason, no reason, arbitrarily, capriciously, Congress can tell us how to live and tell us how to die. And they've done that over the years. They won't be able to do that if we're a state. And the courts have said that because you're admitted on equal footing. You're the same as everybody else. And right now we're not the same.
I actually wanted to follow up on the needle exchange issue because it seems that that is quite clear that this has cost district lives, the lack of statehood.
Absolutely.
This is Congress saying to the district that you could not exchange clean needles. And so in the District of Columbia, where when 1% of a population has HIV or AIDS, it is understood to be a generalized and severe epidemic. The district stands at more than at 3% or more overall, and it's far higher in certain areas. And so when we talk about the lack of needles that the Congress implemented for years, this is an issue which very clearly, it seems, has it resulted in deaths from district for district residents.
Absolutely. They demand from us what they cannot get from their own constituents, and that is policies that clearly and obviously advance death among our population. They treat us as experimental. The things that they, the burdens that they impose on Washington, D.C., they wouldn't even think about doing it back in their districts. But we're an easy mark because, you know, it's parochial. We don't vote for them, so why do they care about us? And statehood cures all of that, cures all of that. We have a presence in the Senate and more than a cloistered presence in the House of Representatives. We're no different than anybody else.
What needs to happen to make the District of Columbia a state?
Congresswoman Norton has introduced a statehood bill. There are no co-sponsors yet. She needs to be vigorous and active promoting it. So it takes a simple majority vote of the Congress and signature of the president. Now, I can tell you, Pete, against the backdrop of my experience on the Hill, I was up there for, I gave a quarter of a century of my life to Capitol Hill. I was chief of staff for three different members of Congress. And I happened to be the staff person who worked the D.C. Voting Rights Amendment. That amendment would not have given us all of our rights, but it would have given us two senators and voting representatives, as well as equal representation in the Electoral College, had it been ratified by the states. Now, but it was passed by the Congress, two-thirds of the House and two-thirds of the Senate, super majorities. We only need a simple majority for statehood, but we passed the D.C. Voting Rights Amendment by super majorities, two-thirds in the House and Senate. We got Barry Goldwater voted for us from Arizona. Now, we had voted against him when we first got the right to vote for president in 64. He ran for president. We voted against Barry Goldwater, but he voted for us on D.C. voting rights. Strom Thurmond voted for us when he was alive, of course. Bob Dole voted for us. In fact, he went to the Washington Monument and gave a speech on why it was we should extend this right to the people of Washington, D.C. Howard Baker voted for us. He ultimately became Reagan's chief of staff. He was a Republican leader in the Senate from Tennessee. So I don't give up on these Republicans like some do. I think with the right package and the right presentation, we can get this job done. And so we don't need that supermajority, and we don't need to go to the states. when we took the D.C. Voting Rights Amendment to the states, because it was a constitutional amendment, we were met by the Hammer, who back then was a state legislator who headed up a group called the American Legislative Exchange Council with Phyllis Schlafly and all them people. And they just had superior firepower. All we need to do is manage this Congress, and we can manage them and get this job done, I think, within the next 3 years. If our leaders in Washington, D.C. have the vision and the commitment to get behind statehood, because it's bread and butter for us, Pete. It ain't about positions for politicians. It's money in our pockets. It's a balanced budget. It's resources to do the kind of things we need. It's having final say on needle exchange and things like that. And I don't see why these people we've elected can't see that. But no, statehood in many ways is an easier course than voting rights. Because once you... have to go to the, and you can't get voting rights, I don't think, without a constitutional amendment. I think the Norton bill, of trying to give a vote in Congress without us being a state, when the Constitution clearly says only states can have representation, has serious constitutional liabilities. So statehood, is the clear answer, and hopefully our leaders will see that, and we'll work to make it happen, because we cannot afford not to be a state.
Vincent Gray, as he spoke throughout the city after the primary, before the general election, I think he had 8 town halls, all the ones that I went to, he was very clear,
yes,
on statehood, not voting rights, and this was. Striking. This is the highest elected official. Now, he shouldn't be the highest elected, or the position of mayor should not be,
right. Should be
the highest elected official, governor and senators and
right.
So on.
That's right.
But this is quite striking that the highest elected official in the District of Columbia is very clear on this issue. Maybe some of his colleagues need to hear him through.
Yes. I'm hopeful that the mayor will follow through on his campaign pledges. I'm counting on it. And hopefully he'll provide real leadership, the kind of leadership we need to get this job done, and that his colleagues will follow that leadership. The jury is still out on that question, but I remain hopeful that Mr. Gray will fulfill his campaign promise.
Right now, Daryl Issa, a congressman from California, is considering investigating Mayor Gray. And this is quite striking. He is a Republican from California. So how is it that he's got the right to look into the district's business? I mean, I was thinking maybe we ought to go to California. He certainly has an interesting past, and look at some of his dealings.
Oh, absolutely. Well, they take Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, the provision that created the district clause, and they equate it to Big Brother, or to a master-servant relationship. They equate it to Congress having the power to rule over us in any circumstance and all circumstances. Technically, Congress does have the power to step into our lives, and that's why we need to be a state. There's really no justification for ISA to do that when we have several entities, local entities, already investigating. The council is investigating. The U.S. attorney is investigating. Moreover, ISA can't do anything about it. Let's assume he, holds some hearings or whatever. He can't do anything about any problems that we have locally. That's the U.S. attorney's job. So it seems to be just another opportunity for him to beat up on us and try to score some points back home or in his party for no reason or any reason. It's unfortunate that they can do that. But statehood cures all of that. We wouldn't have to worry about ICE if were we a state.
At one of the recent press conferences that Gray had, he actually brings up statehood, and it just doesn't catch with reporters. But he was talking about it and how you can have a capital area and separate that from where people actually live, because people don't live on the National Mall and Congress, and that would be one way to approach the statehood issue.
Yeah. Well, in fact, in the Home Rule Bill, which Congress passed, quote, to relieve Congress of the burden of legislating for the district. That's one of the first sentences in the Home Rule Act. I was there when it passed. The Home Rule Act carves out the federal enclave, which would be the area that would not be part of the state, the White House, the monument, the mall, the vice president's home. It's already set out in the Home Rule Act. So it's not a difficult thing to do. Moreover, the district has been reduced in size before in 1846. Virginia used to be part of Washington, D.C., but that 33 square miles went back because Virginia, we didn't have a Pentagon or CIA or any of those federal establishments in that 33 square mile area, and they didn't feel they were benefiting, so they asked for their land back, and by simple act of Congress, by statute, Congress gave Virginia its land back. Now, they could take the remainder of the District of Columbia, make the seat of government, the District of Columbia, the federal enclave, and the rest of it, the residential and commercial parts, including Constitution Hall, would be the new state, whatever it will be named. So it's already done. There's no heavy lifting associated with that task.
All the District of Columbia needs is a majority vote in Congress.
That's all we need. Simple majority in the House and Senate, and Barack Obama has already said he'll sign it. And we're a state. We're on equal footing. We're no different. And our people who spend lonely nights in the bitter cold hills of Afghanistan with only their M16 as a friend or with them, or spend days on the hot sands in Iraq, you know, defending this country, or those who may be flying over Libya or on the ground in Libya, and we do have some troops on the ground in Libya. We've had 40 Congressional Medal of Honor winners from Washington, D.C. over the years. We have more casualties per capita than all but 7 states when we go to war in defense of this country. And so those people will be, their blood will be no different than anybody else's blood if we become a state, when we become a state. It's going to happen in my lifetime, I believe that.
Thanks, Johnny Barnes.
My pleasure.